One of the great arguments against the Bible is the theory of evolution. Most people, virtually all people, just assume that evolution is a proven scientific fact. Well, I want to ask a question, a real simple question. Is it really?
No.
Is it really a proven scientific fact? Or to ask that same thing another way, are there any problems with the theory of evolution? So what I want to do tonight is very simply cover the subject of evolution. In thinking about speaking on this, I said to somebody, you know, of course, books and libraries have been written on this subject. I could take the next 3 years to prepare a series on it. It's enormous, all the stuff that's been written on this subject. So what I'm going to do is try to simplify what this is all about. I intend to cover the theory, what it says, the arguments for it, and the problems with it. So let's start by just defining what evolution is. The theory of evolution is that life began and evolved by a series of mutations and natural selection over a period of time. Is that a mouthful or what? I just said three things. Mutations, what's that? Natural selection, what's that? And over time, that we understand. So to be a little more specific, the idea is this, that sunlight acted on chemicals in the sea to form by chance into one or more single cell organisms which have developed through beneficial mutations and natural selection into all living plants, animals, and of course, human beings. Now that's the, as simple as I can put it, the definition, the concept of the theory of evolution in the terms of the evolutionist. So what I'd like to do next is explain what all that means in the simplest possible terms. Mutation, natural selection. What is all of that about? So let's break it down and let me just very simply explain these various components and see if we can wrap our arms, our mental arms around it. First of all, there are three components: mutation, natural selection, a lot of time. So let's take the first one. What is a mutation? A mutation, very simply, is nothing more than a change. That is the explanation of evolution. It is a change. Now, the theory says there are small changes, and those small changes in an organism is passed on to the offspring of that organism. But the key word you must understand is the word change. So one species has a change, and that change gets passed on to the offspring so that the offspring is different than the parent. But the key word is
change.
Got it. What is natural selection? Natural selection preserves the changes caused by mutation. The process of natural selection preserves the beneficial changes in the organism. One author has said, and I quote, "The beneficial mutation is one that increases the complexity of the organism." Now, my object is to simplify this, so let me just say that the natural selection is a change that is by chance. It was naturally selected. That little change was selected, and a simple way to put it is by chance. So you got two words to remember so far. You got them? Change by chance. Now, to explore that a little further, the change that gets preserved by chance is one that is beneficial. And by beneficial, it means that this simple form is going to develop into a more complex form. So beneficial is complexity. But be all that as it may, what you need to remember are two words, change and chance. Got it? Got it. Darwin himself said, quote, "I will give absolutely nothing for the theory of natural selection if it requires miraculous addition at any one stage of descent." So Darwin laid a lot of weight on the fact that this was by chance. There's nothing supernatural about this. It is a change by natural selection. Natural selection is by chance. That's another way to say the same thing. Now, they use the 50-cent word mutation and natural selection. I'm changing those for nickel words, and they are change by chance. All right, one more concept. Over time. The obvious is that changes do not occur frequently. So, for beneficial mutations to occur and be preserved by natural selection, then it must take place over a long period of time. All right, that is the best I can do to simplify the whole concept of evolution. Did you get it? Three words: mutation, natural selection, over time. Now, this is not the kind of stuff we talk about every day. So this afternoon I sat down and thought, now how am I going to remember this or teach them how to remember this? And I came up with, what are the ABCs? And I could not make mutation, natural selection, and time fit ABC. And I couldn't make it fit XYZ. So I came up with MNO. Those are three consecutive letters in the middle of the alphabet. MNO. What's the M?
Mutation.
What's the N? Natural selection. What's the O? Over time. Had to squeeze that T in there somehow. All right, I couldn't figure out another word for time. I tried. Chronology didn't quite fit like over time. Now, another way to say the same thing is to remember two words, actually, change by chance over time. And if you understand that the change is from simple to complex, and that's called beneficial, and then you've got the change down, and the chance is simple enough, and then over time. Got it? Now, the next thing I want to do is give you the arguments that are used to prove evolution. You ready for this? All right. Now there's a quiz. You got to give me two words, three words actually. Change, chance, time. Now I'm going to give you three more words, and these are the proofs of the theory of evolution. Number one, comparative anatomy. Now, everybody is familiar with this. It's what's in the science books. For example, they will take creatures with all of which have vertebrae, and they will take a creature with a small vertebrae, and then they show bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger animals until we get to humans, and they show that all of them have vertebrae, and the vertebrae increased in size until you get to a human that has a vertebrae. Remember those science books in school? Remember those? For some of you, that's a long time ago. Remember those? All right. That's the proof. There it is. What could be simpler? That's a very impressive picture. You look at that, there it is. Comparative anatomy. The idea behind that argument, by the way, is that similarity demands relationship. Since they're similar, the argument assumes that since they're similar, there's a relationship between each one of those. Or, to say the same thing another way, that one produced the other. That's the relationship. Or, to say the same thing still another way, there's a common ancestry. So, but the point you've got to remember is, it's comparative anatomy, and everybody that's ever seen a science book has seen that picture. Second proof is the embryo in the womb of a mother. The embryo, it is argued, passes through the same stages of development that a human being goes through in evolution. And they argue that, for example, the embryo, when it's a month old, has folds that suggest the gills of a fish. So this one-cell animal that started it all came out of the sea and at one point became a fish and so forth. And so just look at the embryo enveloping in a womb of a mother, and you can see those folds, and that's the gills of the fish. So that's the second argument. There is a third argument, and it comes from geology, only to be more specific, it is the formation of fossils. This is the one you usually hear a lot. When people start arguing about evolution, they talk about the fossils. And the idea is simply this, that if you dig down into the earth, geology, there are strata. And those strata demonstrate that life goes from its simplest forms to its more complex forms. So the fossils are, there we have fossils of simple life forms, and we have fossils of human beings. And the argument is that in the strata of geology, we can see going from the simple to the complex. You ever heard that argument? And let me ask another question. Ever watch the History Channel? Let me ask another question. Ever watch public television and them discuss evolution? That's what they will talk about. Right? All right, there it is. Got it? Repetition's one of the laws of learning. Evolution. Change by chance over time is proven by comparative anatomy, the embryo in a mother's womb, and by fossils in the geographical strata. All right. I began this by saying that there were problems with evolution. Matter of fact, that's sort of my thesis. But I had to explain what evolution is in order to explain the problems that exist with this theory. So what I've done so far is give you 6 points. Got them? Change, by chance, over time, and then the 3 proofs, that's 6. Got it? What I'm going to do next is go through these 6 and show you the problems with all 6. You ready? Let's start with mutation, or, to use the simple word, change. Now, nobody questions that there is change within a species. Everybody is fully aware of change within a species. You can breed dogs. You can breed horses. You can breed plants. There's no question about that. That's called microevolution. And nobody disputes that. I'm not disputing that. Bible believers do not dispute that. That's a fact. That's not the issue. The issue is nobody has ever been able to demonstrate macroevolution. That is a change from one species to another. That's the problem. So that change exists? Yes, within a species. But can one species produce another? Now, I'm going to use an illustration. It may not be perfect, but it does illustrate the point. I think this whole theory has problems at every turn, which I hope to demonstrate. But let me give you the problem with just the fact that there's change that produces another species. For example, you can breed a donkey with a horse, and you get a mule. Now, that's a different animal, right? And the mule can't reproduce. That's the problem. With change producing a different species, it doesn't work. I don't know any other way to say it. What's our second point? Chance. All right. Chance for improvement, or change for improvement by chance, I should say, is just highly unlikely. I mean highly unlikely. An evolutionist has acknowledged this. One said, quote, "In fact, natural selection, that is change, with evolutionary consequences, has only been observed when men have created dramatically new conditions which impose a heavy selection pressure." End of quote. All right. It's got to be simple for me to understand it. All right? So can I make this real simple? How many of you own a smartphone? How many of you own one of the originals, the flip phone? You didn't own a flip phone? You know, one that...
Yes.
You did? Okay, I didn't see enough hands. All right. If I'd have had one, I'd have brought it tonight and laid it up here. And then I would have taken my iPhone, and let me just tell you, it's in this case, and it's the SE. It's the 5 body with the 6 internals, because I just couldn't see why I needed a multiplex camera or something, so I just stuck with my SE. But it's way advanced over that flip phone, right? We all agree with that? I mean, I can't imagine what they're going to come up with next. Well, here's the argument of evolution. If I put the flip phone down on one side of the pulpit and I put my mirror SE on the other side of the pulpit, and then I tell you they changed. It changed. There's no question about the fact that it changed by chance. Just happened. I mean, that sounds dumb and ludicrous, but that's what evolution is saying. They are saying there's change. You can see the differences anyway, and it just happened. That's the argument of evolution. It is change by chance. Now, they say, okay, you may have a hard time seeing that, but what solves the problem is time. If you just give it enough time. You see, there wasn't enough time between that flip phone and that SE. That's your problem. You didn't allow enough time. If you'd have just let that flip phone sit there long enough, it would have changed into, who knows, an iPhone 10. Wow. Well, let me just say very simply, that time is not a cause. Now think about that for just a second. Time is not a cause. Just because time elapses doesn't cause anything. Julian Huxley, a staunch evolutionist, conceded that the mathematical odds against evolution are staggering. One chance in 100,000 in 1,000 to 1 millionth power. That is one followed by 3 million zeros. That's Julius Huxley in the book called Evolution into Action. It has been suggested that if a million monkeys were permitted to strike the keys of a million typewriters for a million years, they might by chance type a copy of a Shakespearean play. Daverheister set up a controlled experiment with one capital letter, continuously typing at a uniform rate of speed and requiring only of the first only the first verse of the book of Genesis. He demonstrated that in a billion years, a million monkeys could never type Genesis 1:1. Now again, you're going to think that's a little foolish, but that's what they're saying. Only they're not saying that over time, monkeys could type Genesis 1:1. They are saying that they could type a Shakespearean play or something comparable. Do you know how complex the human body is? And that just happened by chance over time? That's a problem. That's a problem for evolution. So I submit to you that the concept of mutation changed at all over from one species to another. Natural selection by chance and over time simply has its share of problems. That's a problem. It's not a proven scientific fact. Just on the surface, if you think about it, there are problems. And that is only the beginning. Let's talk about the proofs for evolution. How about comparative anatomy? Similarity does not demand relationships. Similarity could be nothing more than an indication of the same designer. Now, I've been doing this for a while, teaching the Bible. And when I started out, it was back in the 60s. And I just graduated from seminary. And I started out as a young preacher, as an evangelist. And I got a lot of invitations at youth camps to speak because I was young. I actually had black hair in those days, solid black hair. And this always came up. And I can remember back in those days trying to demonstrate to teenagers that similarity doesn't prove relationships. Similarity could just more reasonably indicate a similar designer. And here was my illustration. And this is not going to communicate to some people. I concede that. You have to be of a certain lineage to appreciate this, because it isn't as true today as it was in the 60s. But back in the 60s, Chevrolet made a car. Matter of fact, they made several different species of cars. From the Biscayne, help me here, to the Malibu. Was that the top of the line? Malibu? Bel Air was one, okay. They all looked alike. That is, if you could park them side by side, they all had a similar grill. Remember that? That's taking some of you back, all right. So I would simply say to the teenagers, it's real simple. The Biscayne produced the Malibu. And they would laugh. And I'd say, why are you laughing? That's what evolution is trying to tell you. That simple little life form produced us. And they use comparative anatomy. They show all those creatures with a vertebrae. And the argument is that vertebrae creature produced the next one, and it was a little larger vertebrae, and that one produced the next one, and that. Well, I got another theory. There was one designer sitting in Detroit saying, I like the design, I'm going to put it on every model. I'm telling you, evolution has a problem with comparative anatomy because it doesn't necessarily prove the case. There's another explanation, and I think a better explanation that makes a whole lot more sense than just similarity as a relationship. Not true. All right, how about the whole concept of, where are we? The embryo. The embryo does pass through stages, but that doesn't mean they're the stages of evolution. As a matter of fact, remember that argument they use, the resemblance of the folds or the gills of a fish? Well, it just simply isn't true. The folds of the embryo never function as gills, nor do they have the material of gills. They gradually develop into the jaw and neck of the fetus. Someone has said, the gill split argument offers about as much proof that man evolved from fish as the moon-shaped face of a young Chinese man is proof that he evolved from the moon. Now, it just isn't true. It's speculation at best. It's certainly not some kind of scientific proof. It's a guess, and it doesn't hold water. All right? We've done five of them. They got one more here. That doesn't mean I'm done. It just means I'm going through all five or six. The last one is geology. More specifically, it's the fossils in the geological record. So the problem with the geological argument for evolution is that the geological columns is totally man-made. Remember how I described this? That if you dig down into the earth, there are strata, and that if you look at the strata, the simplest forms come first and then the more complex until you get to man? Doesn't exist. That's a man-made idea. There is no place on the planet where that's true. It's a man-made assumption that simply is not true. Now, if that's the case, and I'll demonstrate in a minute that it is, then the whole theory of evolution goes out the window. You know who said that? Charles Darwin. He based everything on this and said that that was the case. But first, let me tell you this. Let me prove that it's wrong. Have you ever heard of the Cambrian explosion? How many of you ever heard that? You ever heard of the Cambrian explosion? All right, here's what's going on. What really is going on is if you dig down into the earth and see all these strata, there isn't simple to the more complex. Rather, you get to a strata and there is it's called the Cambrian explosion. There's an explosion of fossils, and they're from the simple to the complex. So the whole argument of the fossils simply isn't true, period. There's an explosion of them all in the same strata, not gradually over the strata. All right, the rapid appearance of fossils was noted in the mid-19th century, and Charles Darwin saw it as one of the main objections that could be made against the theory of evolution by natural selection. So let me just point out that then you look at the book, The Origin of the Species, by Charles Darwin, pages 315 to 316. He acknowledges this is a problem. Darwin knew that the fossil record was contrary to his theory, so he blamed it on the imperfection of the fossil record. He knew this was a problem, and he said, well, that's because that's all messed up, not my theory. As a matter of fact, he wrote, and I quote, "For my part, following out Weiland's metaphor, I look for the natural geographical record as a history of the world imperfectly kept and written in a changing dialect of this history we possess, the last volume alone relating only to two or three centuries. Of this volume, only here and there a short chapter has been preserved, and on the last page we have only a few lines." Now that's a little complicated, so let me explain it. He is comparing the geographical strata to a book, as a matter of fact, to a series of books. And he says, what we have in the geographical strata is imperfect. It's as if we only had a volume here or there. We don't have the complete thing. And we only have a short chapter that's been preserved. And on each page, only a few lines. So as comparing it to a book, he is saying, it's all wrong. It's imperfect. That's his word. So the problem is not my theory, it's the evidence. That's almost funny. He also wrote, and again I quote, "All of these causes taken conjointly just have tended to make the geographical record extremely imperfect and will to a large extent explain why we do not find intermediate variations connecting together all the extinct and existent forms of life by the finest gradual steps." So to translate that quote, he is simply saying that it's imperfect, the geographical strata are imperfect, and that's why we don't see real gradual change. We don't see the intermediate changes between this that jumps to this and jumps to that. We don't see the intermediate steps because the geographical strata is imperfect. He also rejected these views on the nature of the geographical record, and he said, and I'm sorry, "He who rejects these views on the nature of the geographical record will rightly reject my whole theory." Quote, Darwin, page 342. Do you get that? You reject this, and you reject my whole theory. Everything hinges on this. Well, the Cambrian explosion disproves this, therefore, there's a problem with the whole theory. He said, quote, "The number of intermediate variations or varieties which have formerly existed in the earth must be truly enormous. Why then is not every geographical formation and every stratum full of such intermediate links? Geology assuredly does not reveal any such finely graduated chains. And this perhaps is the most obvious and gravest objections which can be argued against my theory." End of quote. Did you get it? By his own admission. Now, many reputable scientists have pointed out that the dating is a problem. It's common knowledge now that they date the strata. You can't date the fossils. You can date the strata. But they do it by radioactivity, and it's only good for about 10,000 years. So that's a problem. But here's the point. Are there problems with evolution? Have I convinced you? You already convinced before you came. Were you kidding, right? But there are. There's some serious problems. So I've listed six things. And those six things are mutation, natural selection, time, comparative anatomy, the embryo, and the fossils. And the refutation, or the problem, I should say, is change from one species to another. What about the mule? Natural selection, that is chance change. What about the iPhone? Time, what about monkeys producing Genesis 1:1 or a Shakespearean play? Comparative anatomy, what about the Chevy illustration? The embryo, it simply isn't true. Those folds don't become gills, and fossils, the Cambrian explosion. Blood. I'm not done. There are two more problems. All I've done is lay out the explanation and arguments for evolution and show the problems with all six steps or all six items. Well, let me just say that there are some other problems with evolution outside the theory itself. And one is called the second law of thermodynamics. The second law of thermodynamics states that energy tends toward entropy. That is, every system tends to move from order to disorder. If you don't understand what I'm talking about because it's too heavy, think of the closet at home. You put everything in order, and it goes from order to better order, right? No. Everything in life goes from order to disorder. That's the second law of thermodynamics. Available energy becomes less and less until the state of complete randomness is reached. Thus, all systems are running down. If all systems move toward disorder, life cannot evolve from so-called simple order. The whole universe is running down, not up. Someone has said the clock of the universe is not being wound up, it's winding down. Suggesting that it was wound up by somebody and is now ticking down. Or as one Christian philosopher said, the second law of thermodynamics makes complete random development unlikely. For if the world is trending to disorder, unless there is behind it an orderly power, it would be more and more, if not completely, chaos by now. End of quote. In other words, if there wasn't some other explanation, the fact that it's running down and everybody agrees with that, then it would be complete chaos. Something's preventing that. So the second law is a great argument against evolution. There's one more. Intelligent design. Intelligent design is the idea that the complexities of the universe and living things are best explained by an intelligent cause, not by the processes of natural selection. For example, Michael Behe, a biochemist, argues that there is, quote, an irreducible complexity, end of quote, that cannot be explained by chance mutation over time. He defines this complexity as a single system which is composed of several parts where the removal of any one would cause the system to cease functioning. The mousetrap is an illustration. All parts must be in place at the same time for the mousetrap to work. Removal of any one piece destroys the function. Natural selection could not have created such a complex system because of the selected ability function to present only when all parts are assembled. Now let me explain, because I personally think this demolishes evolution. When Charles Darwin published his book, The Origin of the Species, in 1859, he said it all came from a one-cell animal, a one-cell organism. And that one cell multiplied, and that multiplied, and that multiplied until we created creatures, right? He didn't understand what was in that one cell. He had no way of knowing. We now know what's in that one cell. It's called DNA, you know? It's so complex, it can't just have happened. And it can't have happened one step at a time. It had to have happened all at one time. And the illustration is a mousetrap. You can't lay down one part of the mousetrap and then another part of the mousetrap and then another part of the mousetrap and then another part of the mousetrap and have a mousetrap. You've got to assemble them all at the same time for that to be a working, functioning machine. That is what happened in that one single cell. So evolution, as Darwin explained it, is an impossibility. It can't happen that way. It has to have put together all at the same time. Therefore, I submit to you, evolution has a problem, a huge problem. The explanation of and the evidence for evolution is not supported by facts or reason, and the evidence from the second law of thermodynamics as well as intelligent design argue against it. How are we doing? You say, well, you are just a pastor, and you've managed to come up with all these arguments, and that sounds impressive, but scientists don't buy all this, right? I mean, a well-educated scientist would never accept all this. Oh, really? Well, let me just tell you, that is not true at all. As a matter of fact, I want to come at this philosophically and scientifically for a minute before I close, all right? Let me just tell you, there are great hurdles to evolution, and they are insurmountable. What exists today, this is a philosophical argument, but just think. These are the hurdles you have to overcome to believe in evolution. You have to go from nothing to something. Now, that's a barrier. That's a hurdle. That's an insurmountable hurdle. How do you go from nothing to something? All right, the world started with the Big Bang. Great. Where did the material come from to produce the bang? That's a problem. Then you've got to go from inorganic to organic. So the Big Bang produced the universe, and now we've got the material universe. How do you go from inorganic to organic? And then, all right, so you produce life. You got plant life and animal life. How do you go from animal life to human life? And let me just tell you, the complexity of that is a barrier. Or let me say this. Darwin wrote a letter on June the 18th, 1857. Which is published in a volume called The Correspondence of Charles Darwin, volume 6, page 412. And here's what he said. I am quite conscious that my speculations run quite beyond the bounds of true science. Did you hear that? He conceded that it went beyond the bounds of true science. Science can study the Big Bang forward. They can't tell you where the Big Bang came from. That is beyond science. And Darwin admitted that. So, it's beyond science. If it's beyond science, it must be based on faith. Evolution requires an incredible amount of faith. It requires believing that changes selected by chance called all of life to develop from a single simple cell to the complexity that exists in human beings. I said I was going to get philosophical, then I said I wanted to mention what scientists say. So let me quote a few scientists. Many secular scientists today are questioning evolution. For example, an Australian biologist, an agnostic, this is not a Christian, this is a scientist, an agnostic scientist named Michael Denton has written a book entitled Evolution, A Theory in Crisis. He claims that no one single discovery since 1859, when Charles Darwin published On the Origin of the Species, has supported Darwin's theory. He calls evolution, quote, the greatest cosmogenic myth of the 20th century, end of quote. In his book, he says, quote, it is really credible that random processes could have constructed a reality, the smallest element of which, a functional protein or gene, is complex beyond its own creative capacity, a reality which is very antithesis of chance, which excels in every sense anything produced by intelligent man. A little cumbersome, but he's questioning the fact that chance could do this. Dr. Murray Eden, professor emeritus of MIT, said that Darwin's book, quote, should be made required reading for everyone who believes that what he was taught in college about evolution, end of quote. In 1981, Colin Patterson, senior paleontologist for the British Museum of Natural History, told biologists at the American Museum of Natural History in New York, quote, I woke up and realized that all my life I had been duped into taking evolutionism as revealed truth in some way, end of quote. He went on to say that no real transitional forms had ever been found anywhere in the possible record, and, quote, I don't think we shall ever have any access to any form of an evolutionary tree which we can call factual, end of quote. He challenged a group of scientist at the University of Chicago to tell him one thing they knew for sure about evolution. He said that all he got was silence for a long time. And eventually, one person said, I do know one thing. It ought not be taught in high school. Charles Thaxton, Walter Bradley, and Roger Olson, former evolutionists with doctorates in chemistry, geochemistry, and material science, have written a book entitled The Mystery of Life's Origin, Reassessing Current Theories. That's the name of the book, The Mystery of Life's Origin, Reassessing Current Theories, in which they conclude, quote, a creator beyond the cosmos, end of quote, is the most plausible explanation of life's origin. Evolutionist Dean Kenyon of San Francisco State University wrote that after reading that book, that many scientists hesitate to admit or study the theory's problems because they would open the door to the possibility, more likely necessity, of a supernatural origin of life. Now, folks, it is scientifically, philosophically got problems. I think insurmountable problems. And that it takes a lot of faith to believe that mere chance produced significant beneficial change that eventually led to human beings. I'm going to close by telling you two things. Number one, if evolution is true, humans have no value. Right? You just evolved out of a one-cell animal that floated out of the ocean. So what value is that? Might as well kill a human as kill a roach. If you evolve, that's one of your ancestors. But if we were created in the image of God, and if Jesus Christ died for every creature, that gives human beings, every human being, value and dignity. So I think way beyond the science and the philosophy, there are some real profound problems with evolution. They claim it's scientific, but the science doesn't back it up. There's science against it. So I'm going to close by quoting a book I read recently and change the title. Norm Geisler and another fellow wrote a book entitled, I Do Not Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. And I would submit to you, I do not have enough faith to be an evolutionist. I would much prefer to believe the word we have from God. Father, thank you. Thank you for making us in your image, sending your Son to die in our place, and putting the Holy Spirit within us. We are indeed blessed by the Trinity. And Father, thank you for giving us your word so that we understand where we came from and where we're going. In Jesus' name, amen.